Pam, can we just start at the beginning? Take us back to your husband's condition as his health deteriorated.
All right. Well, in 2005, my husband was diagnosed with colon cancer. He had surgery, and we thought we had got it all. But in 2011, it reappeared and had metastasized into his lungs. And at this point, it was stage 4 lung cancer. He was not a smoker, and neither was I.
And so how did you guys react when you first heard that it had metastasized?
Well, we were really shocked because we thought he just had a cough. And when we went and had x-rays, they originally thought it was just pneumonia. So we thought that's what we were dealing with. Well, we were just basically really, really shocked that it had spread. And but we're both kind of idealistic, optimistic people. And so we just said, okay, all right, let's see what we can do to fight this. And so that's what we began doing.
And eventually at some point, I guess the doctor said there was probably no treatment possible. Is that right?
Yeah, the only thing that we were told was like with a little bit of chemotherapy, there was like a little bit, a 10% of lengthening your lifespan for a couple of months, minus all the side effects. And so we elected against that. So, yeah. So in about January 2012, Ben was really beginning to lose a lot of weight and went from 170 pounds by middle of March to about 120.
And when did he start to talk about perhaps speeding his process of dying?
Well, as I shared, he was down to 118 pounds. He'd lost his voice. He could just whisper. It had spread to his bones, and so he's under incredible pain, could not get comfortable at all. No appetite, no energy. One night he woke me up in the middle of the night, and I was married, Sarah, to a very, very honest man. And he said, you know, Pam, we just need to talk. I look in the mirror, and I see someone from Auschwitz. I love you and Bonnie dearly. That's our daughter and our friends. But he says, I just don't want to keep living like this. And I'd like to explore Oregon's death with dignity law.
How did you react?
I listened, but Sarah, I didn't listen. I listened, but didn't listen. I thought, oh, he's just having a tough night. Tomorrow he's going to wake up and start eating and a little less pain. And that wasn't to be. And the next night, in the middle of the night, he brought it up again. And as I shared with you, my husband was a therapist, counselor for 35 years, and always tried to really instill this with his patients to encourage them to be honest. And he was extremely honest himself. And I knew I had to listen. And so I did listen.
And when he explained it to you, his interest in exploring the death with dignity law, how did he make it something that you could grapple with, that you could understand?
He said, you know, we both had voted for it in Oregon, but it never thought it would actually apply to us because this was more me, that he was 9 years older than I. He would be then 99, in my scenario here. I would be 91. We would be on walkers, go out and take a walk one day, come home, take a nap, and just keel over. Mm. So didn't know anything about Oregon's death with dignity law at all. And he said, I want to find out more about it. Now, he, as I shared, had lost his ability to speak outside of a whisper. So
that was a side effect of the cancer?
Yes, right.
Okay.
So what we did is we made an appointment with our oncologist here in Corvallis and asked her for some help with this, to try to understand a little bit more about it. She was from, just recently moved here to Oregon, was not familiar with the law, and said since Ben was terminal and she was encouraging us to explore hospice, if we did explore hospice, they would be able to help us out with information about Oregon's death with dignity law.
And was it a process for you to begin to accept that this was the choice that he was making?
Yes. I think it was very unconscious at this point because, as I said, he was very honest. And when he said, "Pam, I need your help. This is what I really want," because I loved this man. I was with him for 43 years. I just stepped up to the plate and said, "Okay, I'll do whatever I can to help you out, love."
So what steps did you two have to take to make sure that you complied with the law?
Well, we called hospice, Benton Hospice here, gave us the phone number for Compassion and Choices. I made that call. And at the time, it was the most difficult call I ever had to make, because what I was really doing, Sarah, I was calling to ensure that my husband would be able to die in a peaceful manner. But I made that call, and 2 days later, they called back the next day, and 2 days later, two wonderful volunteers from Compassion Choices. One was Jane, a retired intensive care nurse, and Ani, a retired kindergarten teacher. They came out to our house and answered our questions and explained that there were forms that needed to be filled out and that they would help us with that. And Jane said to me, "Pam, your job right now is just to keep taking care of Ben." And I really, really needed to hear that. So that's how we began the process.
Why did you need to hear that in particular?
I think when you get to this point, when you love someone and you know they're dying, I knew it unconsciously, but I didn't want to admit it. You know, I knew Ben was dying. I just wanted to take care of him. And it was just, I didn't know how to do that. I was confused. And so what was so wonderful, we were on hospice, and hospice is just, we were only on it for a month, but it was our lifeline. It was Ben's lifeline. He would wake up in the middle of the night, and we would have a tough time with his pain, and we got scared. And then he said to me, "Oh, Linda, our nurse from hospice, is coming out in the morning. We'll ask Linda." And that relaxed him and relaxed me.
Right, because, in partnership, one of our jobs, I guess, is to take care of each other. And I guess if your partner is facing terminal illness, then the question becomes, what can I do? How can I help? If helping isn't possible, how do I help?
Right.
Right. So you filled out some forms, mm-hmm. and then what happened? What were some of the next steps?
Well, what happened, and it's something that I'm now working on with Dr. Grube, who you're familiar with.
Who physician. Is he?
Oh, Dr. Grube was the physician who ended up helping us out. He became our prescribing physician. One of the problems, and the reason I mentioned him, and we have formed a medical team in this area with Compassion Choices to help make it easier for other families. What happened with us was that our oncologist was not familiar with the law. It's a difficult thing in this culture to have conversations about death and dying. We're a culture that really likes, that sort of strives for that independent self. Doctors go to medical school. What I've learned is a lot of them do not have geriatric classes, mm-hmm. Palliative care classes. And so it's difficult. Doctors want to heal. They want to fix us. And that's wonderful. But there's a certain point when they can't fix us. And the idea of still being able to be with their patient and offer things like palliative care, or if a patient wants death with dignity, they can help them out with that. But we're still not there yet. There's still some resistance, and it's just trying to be compassionate and working with that. So we didn't have a prescribing doctor, and Ben and I have been both very healthy, so hadn't had a long-term relationship with a doctor. So Compassion and Choices was contacted by someone there here at the Corvallis Clinic, and Dr. Grube, a family physician, 40 years, came out to our house on a Saturday and confirmed he had all Ben's medical reports. He confirmed that he was terminal, very, very ill, And then actually a few hours later, another doctor who was helping in this area came out and consulted and confirmed that Ben was in fact dying, and helped us complete the final paperwork.
And part of that also was their confirming that he was lucid, right?
Exactly, exactly. They had to ask him a question. This cannot be, they can't ask the loved one and say, you know, do your husband think? No, if Ben couldn't speak for himself, he would not have been able to qualify for Oregon's Death with Dignity Law.
Hmm. So he qualified for the law, and then Dr. Grobe prescribed something for him, is that right?
Yeah, what you do is, Dr. Grobe wrote out a prescription for a medication that basically would end Ben's life. You have to wait, I think we got permission on Monday, the week of May. My husband passed away that week on Friday. On Monday, we got permission, then we had to wait, I think it was 48 hours, before the prescription could be filled.
And how long was that prescription in the house before you chose to use it?
Our friends, close friends, drove up to Gresham. We didn't have a local pharmacy, so this is another bit of a barrier we're working on, to have local pharmacies participate. Drove up on a Wednesday afternoon, picked up the medication, came back. They had dinner with us. That was Wednesday afternoon. 2 days later, at 7 o'clock on May 4th, my husband took the medication.
What was it like when the medication actually came into the house? Was that a significant moment for you guys?
Yes. In fact, even before that, Sarah, on Monday, when Ben was laying on the couch in the living room, and I said, honey, we got permission. And I could just see he just became so, so relaxed. He was still in pain, but I could just see a relaxed feeling in him. It was like, oh, you know, I have my choice. I have my choice. And that was and I could see that I was giving him a gift of love by helping him with this. And so it began on Monday, and Wednesday, it continued. In fact, I had I comically say this in interviews who've asked people about my husband. You know, my husband was a diehard Red Sox fan, and a very enthusiastic rooter for them, an enthusiastic rooter for life. As a dad, a husband, friend, and I had him back. He became that peaceful.
Wow. It must have been an incredible last few days with him.
It was. Thursday, two of his dear friends came over, male friends. We sat around our dining room table. Ben was drinking some herbs at this point, Chinese herbs, which helped. It's kind of something they give to chronic asthmatic children, and it kind of opens up your breathing channels so you can have this kind of warmth and not a lot of pressure. So he was drinking that, and I made a pot of split pea soup, and Dean and Peter and Ben and I sat at the table, and it was wonderful. It's something I'll remember for the rest of my life. We're comfortable talking about life and death and choices, and it was wonderful, Sarah.
You know, I have read a couple of essays from people who are in situations somewhat similar to Ben's, who have gone through the process and have the medication actually in the house and are choosing not to use it for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any wavering on Ben's part about this decision?
No. No. He was ready actually to take it the next day.
Did you ever waver?
No. Never wavered. I wish it hadn't had to be like that. You know, I would like to have my husband till I'm 91. You know, that's how I envisioned life. But I was able to out of love.
And I guess I ask in part because you talk about the calm that came over him. mm-hmm. once he had the power back, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what did you guys do on Ben's final day? What was the mood like in the house?
Well, it was really, it was very calm and peaceful. Linda, our hospice nurse, came over in the morning. We had told her that Ben was going to take the medication that day. She came over in the morning for her last visit with Ben and brought us a little necklace that she had made with fish on it. We have one daughter, Bonnie, who just loves fish, and she wanted to give this to her as a gift. So our day began with her, and she brought a bouquet of flowers. And then about 6 o'clock that evening, we invited about 12 of our closest friends to come over so Ben could have a chance to say goodbye to each of them. We played music. One of the couple, Peter, is from New Zealand, and they sang a beautiful Maori song. We read some poetry, listened to some music. And then Ben was having trouble breathing a little bit, so he went in the bedroom. We had oxygen and took some oxygen. And then each of our friends, they were couples, six couples, each of the couples went into the room individually, sat on the bed with Ben, and they talked. And all of my friends have said that they were totally changed for the rest of their life, having seen how Ben was approaching the end of his life and the idea that he could share things with them, gave them advice. My husband was wonderful. He told one of my girlfriends, he said, "Jan, stay away from jerks."
Useful advice.
Useful advice. In fact, he said to me, he said, "Pam, you're," and he said this in front of everybody that last that Friday when we were in the living room. He said, "You know, Pam, you're too trusting. Make people earn your trust." And then he said, "You know, people, don't let people stress you out." He'd said this to me a couple of days before. He said, "Don't let people stress you out, including me." And so because he'd gotten his permission, and I knew that he wasn't going to have to suffer, and he had his choice, I could kid with him. And when he said something to me, I said, "Ben, you're stressing me out." And so we were able to laugh. And so people, friends came in the room, and then we just left it with them if they wanted to be there when Ben took the medication, which was going to be about 15 minutes later, and they said they all wanted to be there. So Jane, our Compassion Choices volunteer, mixed the medication in some applesauce, brought it into the room. All our friends were in the room, standing around the bed. She handed the medication to me. This is a little hard still.
Yeah,
it's been 2.5 years. But it's okay because they're, at this point, they're really healing tears. Mm-hmm. I gave the medication to Ben. He was sitting on the edge of the bed.
And he had to take the applesauce with the medication in it himself, right?
Yes, it was mixed. It's very, very bitter. So, and you know what? I'm going to stand corrected here. I realize it wasn't applesauce. Oh, no, it was, because he had a choice between orange juice and applesauce. You had to have something sweet. So it was, I'm sorry, it was applesauce. So Jane mixed the medication in with applesauce in a little white cup, teacup, with a spoon. She gave that to me, and Ben was sitting on the edge of the bed, and I gave that to him.
And then he
scooped, ate it all real fast.
I can't imagine, I have to be honest with you, I can't imagine being in that position. It must have been so difficult for you not to at least help him. I don't know if he needed help eating at that point.
Well, the thing of it is I knew the law. I can help him. He has to take it himself. That's why there's safeguards in this law, and that's why England, the Parliament, is looking at Oregon's death with dignity law as a template for the law they want to pass. Yeah, it protects So those last moments of someone, you know, all those people are against the law, you know that, no, I couldn't help him. And if someone cannot hold the cup based upon physical disabilities at the point, like with ALS, Parkinson's, they can't hold it. By law, they cannot utilize the law. He took the medication and he laid down on the bed, on a pillow, and I put my hands on top of his. And you can't see this, Sarah, but I think you can envision this. He had his hands kind of folded across his chest, and I put my hands over his, and his hands never, ever quivered. Like, you know, sometimes when he and I were first together and we'd lay in bed and he'd put his hands on across his chest and then he'd be kind of flicking his fingers back and forth, you know, thinking about what he was going to be doing and everything. But with this, they never, never moved.
Like he was fully in the moment.
Fully in the moment.
I wonder if that was some kind of solace for you in that moment, too, that it made it possible for you to be there with him.
Oh, exactly. I mean, I'll hold that for the rest of my life.
So you were all there with him, all 12, 13, 14 of you?
Yes.
And then what happened?
Oh, boy. Okay. It took 2 hours. Ben died. And they confirmed the nurse Jane, retired volunteer. I kept my eyes on her because I didn't know what to expect. And she was there, and that's why I'm continuing to volunteer with Compassion Choices. I couldn't have done this without them. When she confirmed that Ben had died, took his last breath. The other thing is, having never experienced this, what was amazing when Ben, my husband, took his last breath, this is true, Sarah, I felt as though his spirit was just leaving his body. And it was it was like Ben was Ben again. You know, he was out of the only reason my husband is not here today is because his body had stage 4 cancer and was killing him. So his spirit was released.
I don't understand. Can you explain that just a little bit to me? You say Ben was Ben again. What does that mean?
Well, the thing is that he couldn't continue being Ben because Ben was in a body that had stage 4 cancer and he was dying and he was in constant pain. So when he took his last breath, I just felt like he was released and he was just the Ben that was him.
Right.
He could continue being Ben because he wasn't in his body anymore.
He wasn't trapped by the disease.
Right, exactly.
Right. Thank you for sharing that story.
You're welcome.
Do you think that there's, you know, I've read a few stories about people who have had help in dying, who had terminal conditions, and many of them, are psychologists or psychiatrists or therapists like Ben was. Do you think that set him up somehow to be able to confront this more directly?
Perhaps, but I think the bottom thing was his personality before he became a therapist. He was an honest man. He had had enough of life experiences that he reflected on them. He did go into therapy himself before he became a therapist. And I think it was his honesty of dealing with this. It reminded me a little bit, I've read about with Brittany Maynard, when she honestly confronted her situation, faced the facts, and then, you know, struggled trying to figure out what was her choice. And she was able to have her choice. And I think that because of my husband's honesty and facing things, that he was comfortable when he made his choice.
He knew himself well enough to know that he was making the right choice for him or something like that.
Exactly. And there's something that I've learned since, like, when Ben died, I felt like I really deeply felt like I was giving him my last gift of love. And then as I went into counseling with Benton Hospice Bereavement Counseling for myself and also my daughter. And what I kind of learned as I kept reflecting and working and just being with my feelings, that Ben had given me his last gift of love. He showed me what it's like if you're loved and listened to and you're allowed to make your choice, what it does to your life. And so what I've been trying to do with myself, and one of the things is the choice of my doing this.
You mean advocating?
Right, and just having this interview with you right now. Mm. This is a choice I made, and I feel very, very comfortable with it because it's my choice. And that's the other thing that I feel so important, that not everybody's going to choose death with dignity based on their choice, but all of end-of-life choices need to be available to people so they can make their own choice and have that peace of mind. So they can kind of go through life and say, you know, I had a good life all the way to the very end.
Do you think that the way in which Ben chose to die has affected the way you've grieved him?
Oh, yes. I still, you know, riding over here on my bicycle, it's been, you know, 2.5 years plus a month, and I get a little sad, but the sadness, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth, so when I get really sad about him just not being here, it doesn't last as long. And I think what's helping is I'm reflecting more about how he chose to live and the courage he had of choosing the way he wanted to die. And I think that really has helped me, because I know I'm not afraid. I'm still a little afraid of dying, obviously, but I'm not afraid of death the way I was before.
Hmm. If assisted dying wasn't an option in Oregon, if it wasn't a legal option, how would the end of Ben's life been different, do you think?
Hmm. Well, if it wasn't available, we might have tried, like Brittany probably did, tried to, let's say it was was available in another state. We would have moved to the other state. If it wasn't available at all across the country, if he had time, it was less than a month when he began exploring this before he was ready to die. He was very, 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 very ill. So I don't know if we could have made it to Europe.
There, of course, is a controversy in this country about physician-assisted dying. It's still legal in only 5 states. What would you say from your personal experience to the people who oppose it?
Mm. Oh, that's a wonderful question. Well, one thing I'd say, you know, I know how difficult it is when you believe a certain way to allow other people to have their choice that's different from yours. And I know I was raised a Catholic. I'm not a Catholic anymore, but I was raised a Catholic. And I know that some people feel it deep in their heart that if you go through with this, you're going to go to hell and you're going to burn forever and ever and ever. You get that message as a kid and you don't lose it even if you're 69 years old. So I'm compassionate toward those individuals, like doctors who basically feel that way. What I would say to these people out of compassion is that it's so important for you to have your values and have them respected, but also to have compassion for someone who has other values. And if you're a physician and you cannot prescribe for this, that in your heart say, I can't do it, but this is my patient. They're asking for my help. I'm going to refer them to another doctor who can. And for those individuals who don't want to see this happen in other states, I ask you of compassion. I respect your values, but allow other people to have their values respected.
Great. Thanks, Pam. Steve, we're all set? Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Oh, thank you very much for doing this, both you and Sarah.
Yeah.
The more we can have these conversations, and they're not easy on all levels, it's going to become much more normal across our nation and also, you know, in other parts of the world. So we can all have our choices.
Great.
Okay.
And let me just, in case we need it, ask you a kind of lead-in question, which would be,